You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help.
Hi, welcome to Spy Chat. I'm Amanda Olke, Director of Adult Education at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us today. We have two terrific speakers. My boss, Chris Costa, the executive director of the Spy Museum. Have I mentioned that he is in the Commando Hall of Honor, which I think is really cool? And one of my favorite, I guess I always say this, but it's because it's always true. One of my favorite Spy Museum advisory board members, Keith Mosbach, who is a geospatial intelligence expert, and he has been wowing us behind the scenes with some of the stuff he's going to share with us today. Now, before I turn it over, I really want to thank so very much our wonderful sponsor for today's Spy Chat. That is the EKS Group, and in particular, their leadership, Adrian Martinez and Rick Bloomer. Thank you for supporting our programs during this difficult time and for supporting us all the time. So without further ado, over to Mr. Costa.
Amanda, thanks for the great introduction. As always, thank you everybody for supporting Spy Chat. We've held it virtually while we have temporarily been closed. We're looking forward to reopening soon here at Spy. So keep checking our website. We're really excited about that. Again, this is a special Spy Chat because this is first time we've ever had sponsorship. So again, I have to say thank you to EKS. And I'm really excited also to work with Keith today. So without further ado, the first article that I am tracking on intelligence, I think, is very interesting. It's titled, Germany Wants EU to Sanction Head of Russian Military Intelligence. That was a New York Times piece that talked about Chancellor Merkel's ire, really, that the Russians have waged cyber warfare. In particular, back in February, they attacked the German parliament, a cyber attack, that is. So in retaliation, the Germans are going to invoke a seldom used, actually it's new, a European sanctions tool against the head of Russian military intelligence, as well as the individual hacker that happens to also be on the FBI's most wanted list. So more to follow on that. I just think it's an interesting 21st century story on cyber and a response by a state like Germany. The next story that I'm tracking is related to Saudi Arabia, and I find this particularly interesting. The title is, the former intelligence official was a hero. He's now a target of a brutal campaign by MBS. And I think most folks know that MBS is Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince in Saudi Arabia. There's a bit of a Game of Thrones, if you will, going on. But one of the victims of this is arguably an individual by the name of Al-Jabri. Al-Jabri in the early 2000s really brought Saudi Arabia into the 21st century with their intelligence service, in particular the Mabath. I practice saying that all the time. That is the Saudi Internal Intelligence Service. They are very good, and they've been modernized, and they work very closely with Western intelligence services. And individuals at CIA, former luminaries like George Tenet, former DCI, has spoken out against these campaigns, as well as Michael Morell, the former acting deputy of CIA and a great friend of Spy Museum. So we're watching the story closely. Again, this is not surprising. This back and forth has happened for some time as MBS seems to consolidate his power. The problem is Al-Jabri was a great partner, and we want to make sure we take care of our Western partners. So we'll continue to watch this particular story. On counterintelligence, I'll be brief because this is really a follow-up of what's been happening with the tit-for-tat with China on a counterintelligence front. What am I talking about? The United States is ready to expel and not approve visas for Chinese students that are linked to military intelligence institutions or academies in China. If I said that right, the implication is about 3,000 Chinese will have their visas denied or canceled or be forced to go back to China. That impacts US universities, but there is a real counterintelligence threat, as we have pointed out in previous programs. The next area I want to talk about, three stories of interest to me and maybe of interest to you, related to counterterrorism and terrorism. So the headline is police charge Canadian teenager with terrorism in an alleged incel murder back in February. So what is incel? It stands for involuntary celibate. It's angry young men who come together, self-reinforcing, self-radicalizing online in a ecosystem where they're able to share their frustrations at not being able to develop relationships with women. As a result, about 50 people have been injured or killed since 2014. So this is of interest because of the attack in February and the fact that the Canadians called it an act of terrorism. I have talked to my friends in the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and they're tracking this case closely. There are cells and individuals that live in the United States as well as Canada, in other countries as well. So greater scrutiny, greater analysis going forward. The next story I want to talk about, and I transition to Afghanistan, we keep coming back to that because peace and reconciliation hopefully will break out in Afghanistan, but there are some analytical questions about whether the Taliban is cooperating with ISIS on terrorist attacks in Afghanistan. In particular, this is playing out with senior unnamed Afghans that are very concerned that there's cooperation between the two groups, to include the attack that took place in a maternity ward not too long ago, where many innocents died, to include babies and young mothers. It was a tragic attack, but the question is whether there is cooperation between the Taliban and ISIS. Now, they're ideologically removed from each other, but there may be some Taliban that are fleeing to ISIS, not happy with the possibility of peace breaking out. So we'll watch this closely. It's really an analytical judgment question as well as a policy issue moving forward. The other issue I want to talk about, which is very germane, it's very relevant, it's about Antifa, anti-fascist, fascist, not organization, and that's an important distinction, but a movement, loosely affiliated people that want to provide self-defense, in their words, to protect protesters in the event right-wing extremists show up, as they did in Charlottesville. The question is Antifa a terrorist organization? And the answer is, it is not a terror group, it is a movement. But that said, the president, when he said he wants to declare Antifa terror group that really translated to labeling, which he certainly can label them a terrorist group, but it has no real teeth insofar as focusing resources that you would on a foreign terrorist group. But what it does translate to is really heightening the prioritization, having joint terrorism task forces in the United States look and investigate Antifa to make sure they're not mobilizing for violence. Pause. I also have to talk about far-right extremists because they are, in fact, mobilizing for violence as well to affect protests. And they have attacked federal officers since the killing of George Floyd. They have attacked federal officers on the West Coast, and I believe a highway patrolman. The point is, extremists on the both sides of the spectrum will take advantage of protests. The question is, how will the United States handle that from a policy standpoint? If there's no nexus with a foreign terrorist organization overseas, really what that means is the FBI and Homeland Security will continue to make sure that violent actors are not moving to a protest really to create violence, to sow more disunity. So that story will continue to play out. There was an excellent op-ed that was published today about the hysteria surrounding Antifa. It was published, I think, in the New York Times. All right, transitioning away from terrorism, I'd like to talk about wrongful detentions. So I'd like to talk about two cases. A good news story, the release of Michael R. White. He's a former sailor. He's been held by the Iranian regime for 2 years. In my mind, it was a wrongful detention. It was another Westerner that was rolled up as a bargaining chip. That's the way Iran seems to behave. Hold somebody, try to negotiate. And of course, we don't have direct diplomatic ties to Iran, we, the United States. So countries like Sweden, perhaps, or Switzerland are involved as interlocutors. I think Switzerland most recently. All of that said, he was released after 2 years because of diplomatic pressure, and he was recently released. Some of the United States held on some charges related to probably violating sanctions. He was returned to Iran. So we continue to put, and again, the United States, diplomatic pressure on Iran. They continue to behave in a malign fashion. There are three other hostages we want released from the United States wants to release, and other Westerners. Transitioning to another wrongful detention. So this is a fascinating case. I have spoken about it to the media 2 years ago and a couple times since. The case of Paul Whelan, a former Marine who went to a wedding in Russia, and he was passed a thumb drive. On that thumb drive, purportedly there was classified information. Ergo, he was considered a spy. For 2 years, he has been held, and finally he was sentenced to a breathtaking 16 years in the Russian penal system. Now, in my opinion, this is an analytical judgment. Whelan has had no relationship at all with the U.S. intelligence community, and this is a provocation by the Russians. They're very adept at that, and they'll probably hold out for some kind of trade. Again, it's a part of their malign diplomacy. I saw some remarks from Ambassador John Sullivan. He is very unhappy, and he's a fighter. I'm glad he is the U.S. ambassador to Russia. Okay, the final two stories I want to talk about in brief, I think, are fascinating. One is the Palestinian Authority President Abbas. Recently, he has quietly, apparently, terminated his intelligence sharing with Israelis as well as the United States. And this is really important. I had an opportunity to meet and talk to Abbas a couple of years ago, and it was very important to reinforce the priority of ensuring that the Palestinian Authority continue to share information on terrorism as it related to Israeli security, as it related to Palestinian security. If those relationships are curtailed, I think it puts Israelis at risk, and it certainly puts Palestinians at risk. And if you're wondering why, this is related to apparently some diplomatic decisions, domestic decisions in Israel to annex more land in the West Bank. So watch that story. It'll play out in the future. And finally, I'm not going to say a lot about it. This isn't a book endorsement, but I highly recommend that you follow the case of John Bolton. DOJ is trying to stop his memoir that apparently has classified information in it. His editors deny that. It's a very interesting case of First Amendment rights and the importance of going through a process of making sure you do not have classified information. Whether it's been politicized by the White House or not, that's part of the story. Continue to watch it develop. It'll be interesting to read some of Bolton's insights, but really the largest story for me in the Spy Museum is to watch the debate, the back and forth, while the Department of Justice tries to do a cease and desist order so the book is not sold widely next week. And finally, I just want to offer that normally I'm reading an intelligence book. This month, I've taken a break, which is very rare. I'm reading a book on Lyndon Johnson titled The Tragedy of Lyndon Johnson's, appropriately from my dad's library. I'm dusting it off and reading it about really the time of civil rights, the 1960s, and domestically how the United States was dealing with all kinds of change. I think it's worth taking a break every once in a while. And I think you can find that book. It's been reprinted. It's a classic. Anyway, without further ado, it's really important that we hear from Keith because he has a lot to say and we can't wait to hear your questions. Thanks, Keith.
Thanks so much, Chris. And Amanda, thank you for the very kind words. You're always able to put such a positive light on things. I'm really privileged to have the opportunity to be part of the team, part of the family at the International Spy Museum. I learned so many things from my colleagues there, and it's been a great journey into the new facility. And while certainly been interrupted here necessarily by COVID-19 precautions, as things begin to open up and people can get in to see that fantastic collection in that superb facility, those who have seen the Spy Museum before, I think, will be excited. Those who have never been will certainly be excited. I hold down a challenge in my engagement with the Spy Museum in that there's lots of espionage talked about at the Spy Museum. And I always like to remind them that spying goes far beyond that. And it gets into my area of interest and my background, which is geospatial intelligence, which includes remote sensing and location information, data analytics and data visualization, sort of all wrapped up. So I'm going to take a whirlwind tour here, as Chris did, through a bunch of things that are going on in the geospatial intelligence community that you might not have heard of, but they're happening. They're happening right now. So first is a bunch of launches. The SpaceX crewed launch for NASA recently got a lot of attention. The eyes of the world were on that launch. US getting back into space with its own rocket was very exciting. What most people probably haven't paid much attention to is the 13th of June, the National Reconnaissance Office, part of the intelligence community that builds and operates the spy satellites, if you will, launched out of New Zealand on a rocket as part of a ride share. And that's actually a thing on launches where several satellites will go up on one rocket and kind of go do their own thing. So you have the National Reconnaissance Office launching a satellite out of New Zealand, not something many of us in our community would have thought possible just a few years ago. That was June 13th. On the 15th, SpaceX, a Falcon 9 rocket as well, went up with 58 Starlink satellites, part of Elon Musk's communications system in space. I think they've got about 540 satellites up there now. They normally on the Falcon 9 would go up with 60. This time they went up with 58 because they took three SkySat satellites from Planet, which is a company that has a number of satellites on orbit, probably somewhere in the area of 120 to 130. At this point. So the SkySat satellites, very, very capable. They get down to 50 centimeter spatial resolution. But what's also very exciting that people don't talk about too much is temporal resolution, which is how often are they able to visit the same point on the Earth. So you'll have 50 centimeter resolution from the SkySat constellation alone, by later this year when they put up their full, they could get up to around 21 in that constellation, revisit as many as 12 times a day in a lot of the major populated areas of the Earth. BlackSky, another remote sensing company, will launch two satellites on the 24th of June, also on a Starlink launch. And they plan four more this year, launching out of India, ultimately with about 16 satellites. And then, of course, ICEYE is a Finnish remote sensing company with synthetic aperture radar. We're using radar imaging from space. They put up their two most recent satellites just about a year ago. They are doing synthetic aperture radar imaging through clouds at night as with 25 centimeter resolution. So pretty exciting stuff. So lots of things going on in space besides just NASA crewed launches. The next one I want to talk about, something I just saw yesterday, and this is a great exemplar of open source intelligence, less so necessarily about geospatial intelligence, although there's a little bit of that in here, but this is a great exemplar of what we call open source intelligence. So a young woman threw a Molotov cocktail into a police car in Philadelphia. There were images taken of her, both cell phone images and others, and the police were able to identify her tattoo pretty clearly, and a t-shirt that she had that was rather unique. They were able to trace that t-shirt to a store on Etsy. Once they found the store on Etsy that sold that t-shirt, they happened to notice a review by a woman who lived near Philadelphia. They took that name of that person who did the review and they went to LinkedIn. They also looked on Instagram and some things on Vimeo for the original identification. Ultimately took that to LinkedIn, identified her place of business, went to that website, saw pictures of her on the website, and very clearly showing off her tattoo. And that allowed her, them, of course, to identify her positively and then go and arrest her. Ultimately, I think she was arrested by the FBI. So think about that chain of events, that her tattoo and her t-shirt were what ultimately betrayed her. And obviously, she faces a number of legal problems. Interesting, her attorney has already pointed out they have grave concerns about privacy with respect to how his client was tracked down and arrested. And many would suggest those are all open sources. I've got five children between the ages of 18 and 26, and I think they would refer to this perhaps as just common internet stalking of someone they might be interested in or curious about. But we'll see what happens there. Some of you might have heard, moving on, about a story a few weeks ago about some slides that were apparently leaked, unclassified slides, pointing out what they felt to be a rather damning indictment of open source intelligence collection against a lab in Wuhan, saying that it made clear that the virus originated out of that lab, calling out sometimes where there were odd absence of cars or roadblocks in the area. Immediately upon this being released and to some fanfare in the press, true professional open source analysts were able to take a look at it and start to systematically debunk each one of the claims using imagery from Maxar satellites and Airbus satellites, as well as cell phone ping location data and activity data. There were some basic mistakes in the assumptions in these slides, in this intelligence analysis. Not understanding the impact of a Chinese holiday, for instance. Not understanding that roadblocks were not anything nefarious, but rather just an indicator of construction, right? Which is something we all deal with here during road construction. Systematically, experts like Jeffrey Lewis at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies, spends a lot of his time looking at North Korean and other nuclear issues, Iranian nuclear issues, was able to kind of go through this with his skill set and his analysts and kind of take it apart. So it is a dual edge here. People made an intelligence call based off a bunch of open source analysis and then had that open source analysis shredded by other analysts. So very interesting time there. Something else you may not have heard of, some of you may recall the in January of 2018, a discussion about Strava, which is a fitness app that has very precise location data, allowing people to take a look at running routes. Maybe when they get to a city where they're not familiar, they're able to track their times over time around the same routes, measure them very precisely, et cetera. So great fitness tool if you can have that level of accuracy. The problem was it was being shared very widely, and they actually found U.S. military forces running around the perimeters of heretofore undisclosed locations in the Middle East, and those things were being uploaded and tracked. And so not only were they identified as U.S. military personnel at a place where we didn't ever acknowledge having them, but they were tracing the fence line of the facility very clearly by trying to get the most area in for their daily runs. Well, it's happened again, and that is the Untapped Beer app also has location, and people are drinking beer and checking in and very proud of the craft beer that they've added to their achievements, but they're also tied to location and to the location company Foursquare, which has been fostered out of a formerly a check-in app itself into a very powerful marketing and retail sales location tool. So the Untapped Beer app has now become a security problem for the U.S. military and intelligence folks. Ramstein Air Base alone showed 600 unique users logging over 2,600 beers in just a very short period. So both the Air Force holding its own there, but those of us know that people transiting of all services and all types of government agencies are transiting through there. So the Air Force shouldn't hold all the credit or blame, depending on how you're thinking about it. So the Untapped Beer app has become a problem from an operational security or OPSEC perspective. Lots of discussion in the press, moving on here to surveillance of protesters. And that could be video, that could be from surveillance cameras, that could be ground video, that could be the automated license plate readers, that could be individual body cameras of officers who are at the protest. And where is all this data going? We also have seen evidence that the Customs and Border Protection folks are flying drones over areas in the United States far away from borders. So what does this say about how we have managed to regulate the types of surveillance that are available to our law enforcement professionals? Where is it justified? Where are they using that surveillance power? It also gets to cell phone tracking and things of that nature. Interesting warrants that were issued during the course of the protests were geofenced warrants. So rather than saying they wanted to look at a specific person or activity, they were able to get a warrant that said we want to be able to surveil a very specific area, and that geofence could be drawn around it, and it could be rather large, which is, you know, not something that warrants have traditionally been known for being so broad. So I think it's interesting the industries that connect in and around this have talked about self-regulation for some time. IBM, Amazon, Microsoft, for instance, all recently announced that they would stop providing their facial recognition technologies, at least in the near term, to law enforcement, pending some ability to have a discussion about this, the technologies, and where it's headed. So the last thing I'd like to address, as an intelligence professional, I can certainly get a little concerned although as an intelligence professional, I'm very used to the phrase that we have in our community, which is there are only two types of operations, operational successes and intelligence failures, right? And we learn that early on in our intelligence careers. But once again, I've seen headlines over the last few days about the intelligence failure of coronavirus. So I just like to point out that in November, I'm gonna read you some lines that were written by the intelligence community on the 15th of November, and see if these sound, you know, familiar. The emergence of a novel, highly transmissible and virulent human respiratory illness for which there is no adequate countermeasures, there are no adequate countermeasures, could initiate a global pandemic. Experts consider highly pathogenic avian influenza strains as likely candidates, but other pathogens such as SARS coronavirus also have this potential. If a pandemic disease does emerge, it will probably first occur in an area marked by high population density and close association between humans and animals, such as many areas of China. Under such a scenario, inadequate health monitoring capability within the nation of origin probably would prevent an early identification of the disease. Despite limits imposed on international travel, travelers with mild symptoms or who were in fact asymptomatic could carry the disease to other continents. The absence of an effective vaccine and near universal lack of immunity would render populations vulnerable to infection. So I'd say by any measure, that would suggest that the intelligence community did in fact anticipate this and did in fact alert not just decision makers, but the public. This was in an unclassified document. And I know I mentioned that it was written on the 15th of November, but I think I may have forgotten to mention it was written on the 15th of November, 2008. So for people who would like to suggest that the intelligence community didn't see this coming and didn't tell people it was happening, I'd suggest that they go see the Global Trends 2025 report by the National Intelligence Council that was issued on the 15th of November, 2008, page 75. So that's all I've got pending getting to the question and answers.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
Hi, where is our Mr. Costa? There he is. Well, that was a very wonderful way to end, Keith. A little bit of time travel back to a different decade. And I will jump right into the questions unless you have, either of you have any further comments. This is a very specific question. I wonder what exactly they want to know, but can you discuss what is happening in the global geospatial intel research building in White Sands?
Yeah, so absolutely not, but I'd love to hear some new questions.
Exactly. This one's can you or will you answer, Chris?
No, I'm going to punt on that one.
Okay, well, I will as well then. I'll follow the proper lead. An interest in, with all the satellites being launched and then perhaps left, are there concerns about space debris? Are there agreements in place about handling that and managing that? And if so, could you let us know? And something fell down in my house. My apologies.
So make sure that's not a piece of space debris, perhaps.
It is. Oh my gosh, it is.
In any event, yes. There are a number of international treaties and agreements that create the opportunity for very responsible activities in space. It was easier many years ago when there were only a few players to come together under international treaties and have agreements on the types of things that one would do to make sure that they were responsible citizens in space. That is, carrying enough fuel on your spacecraft and maintaining a reserve so that when you have reached the end of life, if you are in a low Earth orbit, you are able to successfully maneuver that out of orbit, in an area where it will burn up in the atmosphere. If you are in a higher orbit, there's a regime where you use that remaining fuel to fire your engines and go straight up, essentially, into an orbit that will not decay in any of our lifetimes or our children's or their children's. So we kind of just, in that case, we send them way, way up. But certainly both there have been examples of the US many years ago, but more recently China and India, conducting any satellite tests in low Earth orbit, well, and beyond, and the Russians as well. And this has left tremendous debris fields in low Earth orbit. So, you know, let's put things in perspective. The International Space Station is in low Earth orbit. It is traveling at about 17,500 miles per hour. A penny, a bolt, a piece of debris of that size traveling at that same speed, hitting the International Space Station could be catastrophic. And I think we saw the Sandra Bullock, George Clooney movie some years ago that dramatized some of that. So yes, there is a way to be a responsible citizen in space. There's a way to anticipate and adhere to international space treaties and agreements, but not everybody does that. And as more entrants join the space arena, some don't necessarily want to spend the money required to be able to be those responsible citizens. And then pressure has to be applied by other countries to try and get them to do that. But again, the most dangerous issue with respect to space debris at this point truly has been those anti-satellite tests that have created these debris fields that have to be watched very closely, monitored very closely. And in fact, places like the International Space Station and other satellites are maneuvered on occasion when a conjunction is predicted.
This incredibly timely question, are we able to use any of our tools to verify the seriousness of the clash that's happening right now between China and India?
Absolutely, it's a wonderful question. I was looking at some open source imagery this morning. It's very clear to see some of the Chinese movements. These are classical sort of Cold War imagery exemplars. We spent a lot of time over the last 20 years hunting people and single vehicles and having to manage that as intelligence problems. Chris and I come from an era where tracking large Soviet, then Soviet formations, and the Chinese move in a similar manner. So it's quite easy to track their logistics bases, to track movements of units, to identify those units, and to a certain extent do that on the Indian side as well. And given the commercial imagery that's available now and both the spatial and temporal resolution that I talked about earlier, there are any number of people at universities, at think tanks and others who are tracking this very clearly. And I'd say a quick web search, you'd be able to find some very clear pictures of that activity.
If I could jump in there also to complement that kind of collection that Keith just talked about, of course you have, you know, diplomatic channels. You also have clandestine human. There are sources out there from many countries that are reporting on this, because we should remember that China and India went to war in 1962. So flash forward to 2020, both of those countries are nuclear powers. So this would be a high priority for the US intelligence community and just the world community to understand how serious is this border dispute. Is it going to escalate? And China, candidly, is under a lot of pressure right now in Hong Kong for failures, in quotes, on the pandemic. So again, this is a very contentious border, but we have multiple ends to include open source intelligence. So this is an important requirement. We would pull all stops, right, Keith?
Thanks, Chris. One more thing, Amanda. I sort of have open source on the brain here. Certainly, classified sources absolutely all work. The power is when it all works together. It's you know, one of the things I've done in my background is what's called intelligence integration or intelligence surveillance and reconnaissance integration. The idea is, what are we hearing from our signals intelligence intercepts? What are we able to get in the cyber realm? Chris's points about diplomatic and clandestine human sources on the ground, as well as taking a look through our very exquisite geospatial intelligence tools that we have available, and putting it all together to create a picture that allows people, decision makers in the White House, to anticipate what's going on and not just see it as a history lesson, and also to provide it to our forces in the region and our commanders in the region so that they understand what's happening and what will probably happen based on analytic the analytic picture.
Well, referencing OSINT here, one of the questions harkens back to, you know, untapped beer, except is there any way, you know, for the military to kind of massage this and get less information flowing out there on OSINT channels?
Yeah, this is tough. All the military services have briefings that, interestingly, it's sort of a collaboration between their public affairs folks and their intelligence, counterintelligence folks to make soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines aware of these myriad devices that they now carry and what the footprint looks like, what sometimes referred to as digital dust that they're leaving where they go. There's a, you know, a famous incident that was really sort of seminal in this movement to bring this under control when three or four brand new, very advanced Apache helicopters were brought into a base, an operating base in Iraq. And of course, the soldiers were intensely proud of getting this fantastic piece of equipment and took pictures and posted it to the web. And those pictures had embedded location information, and those aircraft were destroyed by enemy fire pretty quickly thereafter because we actually targeted it functionally. Those soldiers targeted those aircraft themselves by sending out imagery with embedded location data. So yeah, there are lots of efforts to educate folks in the military, educate folks in the intelligence community about the dangers of this trail that they're leaving. But the reality is it is a tough challenge in an era where we're all so connected by so many different devices.
I'm going to lump some things together that shouldn't necessarily be lumped together, but I think it makes sense as a broad discussion point. So bear with me. People are asking about Antifa and what makes it seem like a terrorist group, as opposed to just an anarchist movement, and then thinking about the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone in Seattle, which has now become the Capitol Hill Occupational Protest CHOP. How, you know, what is the chance of that becoming terrorist? This is a question from the audience. So I thought those kind of went together in terms of domestic issues, if you will.
So I can take a stab at it and then hear from Keith as well, his perspectives. So I'll offer this. I was actually at the White House working on counterterrorism during Charlottesville. So knowing this was a domestic situation, the best I could do was work, you know, almost all night, just monitoring through Homeland Security and FBI any concerns that agitators were coming in to commit violence, political violence, motivated and mobilized because of their ideology. And in this case, in many cases in Charlottesville, it was about far right activists. And of course, a far right activist, or however you define him, a white supremacist that was motivated to kill an innocent protester, executed that. And subsequently, I think is if not going to receive the death penalty for that, certainly will spend the rest of his life in jail. All of that said, the roles and responsibilities for policymakers is to keep, in that case, to keep leadership informed. Similarly with Antifa, so Antifa as well as far right, as I probably didn't go as deep as I would like to, but I'll be brief here. Antifa, again, is a movement. It's not a terrorist organization. President can label it and say, I want to designate a terrorist organization. Other right-wing organizations, and there's a history of left-wing violent organizations that have been classified terrorist by the nature of what they do as far as property damage goes and political violence. But for all intents and purposes, those groups in the United States are handled like any other criminal element, with the exception of joint terrorism task forces might assign officers to investigate those crimes. But in the case of Antifa, in the case of far-right extremists in the United States, we have to be mindful, and I say this all the time, as repugnant as it is, it's not against the law to be a member of Antifa. It's not against the law to be a white supremacist or a neo-Nazi. So they have First Amendment rights. So investigators have to approach it cautiously. Now that said, and I'll finish up by this, the administration has recently said that the Russian Imperial Movement, a white supremacist organization, is essentially a foreign terrorist organization. This is very, very important. And it didn't happen while I was at the White House. It happened afterwards, but I applaud it because what it means is this group that has training camps in Russia, they also have an online presence worldwide. They also sow disunity on the internet and have a radical right ideology of hate. But at the same time, they want to mobilize for violence. They have been declared a terrorist organization. They will be sanctioned and they will be shut down over time because we'll use diplomatic intelligence, probably not military, but certainly economic sanctions will be applied against that problem. So that just gives you a sense. But insofar as Antifa goes, I want to finish on this point. It is not an organization with a hierarchy. It is a movement, loosely affiliated people. In some cases, they're following doctrine, in some cases, from the far right, where they don't organize so that they can move in and out. They don't communicate. In some cases, they will act on their own. And that's part of the strategy of the far right and the far left for those that want to be violent.
Keith, any comments on that?
Yeah, so, you know, I pride myself on being an all-source intelligence officer who has sort of fallen into this geospatial intelligence niche, but I'm going to tread lightly here in Chris's defined area of expertise. But just to say that there are all the things I've talked about during some of my initial exemplars of surveillance of protesters and, tracking apps and, thinking then extrapolating to contact tracing and quarantine, how have people been paying attention to quarantine? We're in a very interesting time where these technologies are kind of transcending both things like retail and marketing and law enforcement and intelligence. The American people have traditionally had tremendous protections against their own intelligence system being used against them. And, that was revisited after some abuses and then strengthened during our history. But we really have to understand now both the opportunities and the concerns we might have about how these things are used, right? If they are used to be able to quell violence and to hold people accountable who are not part of peaceful protesting, but are there as agitators who are parts of these things that Chris has defined. Well, I think many of us could feel pretty positive that that's an excellent application of those technologies. When it goes beyond that is when it starts to get disconcerting. And when does it cross over into something that is infringing upon our rights? So it's interesting times.
Yeah, one more, just a separate question about Antifa. Someone said Breitbart had posted an expose saying that they were getting operational training from abroad on tradecraft. Have you seen anything on that that you thought was worth mentioning?
So I've actually made a few phone calls to folks that are plugged in, obviously, and I want to be responsible. I would just argue that as of the time I called some of my former colleagues across the government, there was no direct linkage to overseas entities. But that is increasingly changing because of the internet, right? So mm-hmm. That poses some challenges. But again, if there is a nexus to foreign intelligence services that are fomenting and helping to train Antifa, as in the case of Russian Imperial Movement, where they have training camps and they're linked to white supremacists in the United States, that will change the dynamic. So the intelligence community has to tread somewhat carefully, but they have to investigate to make sure there are no foreign ties. And I can't stress enough, that would be for Antifa that would be for far-right extremist groups. And with Russian imperial movement, I can say that I'm confident that if the intelligence community finds that nexus, then ultimately it's up to policymakers to decide what happens next, or diplomats, right? It's not all about kinetic attacking terrorist camps. It'll start with diplomacy. It will start with sanctions. So these are important questions, and they're excellent questions from the audience.
So this is goes in the category of Stump, the Q&A moderator. And if I were off camera, I'd Google this to find out. But was Gorgon Stare activated in U.S. during protests?
Yeah. So let me describe what it is. So I'll be your Google here, Amanda. It would be irresponsible of you to do that right now while you're trying to moderate. It was really a phenomenal capability that was developed when we needed to understand what we referred to as pattern of life in Iraq, Afghanistan, Horn of Africa. Being able to understand what activity around a village, around an area looked like, so that then, in fact, we'd be able to understand when there was a change, right? When there was a delta to that activity. Gorgon Stare was an ambitious project. I think there was probably some DARPA play in that, but it allowed for a very wide area surveillance from an aircraft or even an aerostat, but also with the ability to have a very high resolution HD spots throughout that wide area that could be identified. So you could have a broad area at fairly good resolution, but then multiple spots that could be steered within that to get extremely high resolution, right? That would not be the type that's available from space. So I am not aware that it's been deployed by law enforcement agencies or anywhere in the United States. It's a pretty complicated system that requires, you know, back-end analytics and the ability for people to manage that. There you go. I can tell you what it is, because it's certainly not classified, but I'm certainly not aware whether it's been deployed domestically.
If I can also jump in, just because sometimes it's fun to talk about old school tradecraft in the realm of human intelligence. So old school is going into a village, maybe to spot, develop, and ultimately recruit a source in a village in Afghanistan or a village in Iraq. If you don't have tools that I'm not familiar with, then old school, you go into the village and you're wondering if the past few days that you've been there, when you're waving at folks and trying to establish a modicum of rapport, if they don't wave one day or if there are no children to give candy to, these are indicators that there might be some attack planning. This builds up over time, but before you had the technologies, it was all about getting out into the villages and doing human sensing, talking to people. And are they smiling? Are they offering you some tea? So that's how we negotiated through, you know, basic anti-terrorism measures, defensive measures, counter-ambush, by fundamentally understanding the operating environment. It is hugely helpful, though, to have predators providing you oversight and top cover and other capabilities that the United States has, to include SIGINT, looking for some kind of anomalies in the signals intelligence environment. So it's fun to reflect on how things have changed.
Well, here's another old school one. Germany has accused Russia of an assassination in a Berlin park. Legal sanctions seem ineffective. Has the West just given up on dealing with these wet jobs, as we call them?
So there is a unit, I forget the number designation, it doesn't matter, it's not relevant, but last year
007, license to kill.
No, I think they were very OPSEC savvy and decided that wouldn't work out well for them. But some number sequence of an organization that does three things really: cyber attacks, as well as active disinformation. And under the rubric of active measures, like the Soviet Union used to do, the Russians have continued to conduct assassinations, which again, as everyone knows, Oleg Kalugin, one of our board members, talks about it. I've spoken about it. We've done programs on it. Assassinations hasn't gone away. And I think that the question is excellent, and it might relate directly to a Chechen. So you have a Chechen in Germany that was a target of the Russians. They decided to go after that Chechen. He was one of their targets, and they assassinate him. But also that same numbered unit, I believe, has also been complicit in maybe poisoning somebody in Bulgaria, I believe. The bottom line is Russia is extremely aggressive on the front of going after dissidents. And they're not the only ones. Obviously, we've talked today about the Mabahith. They're internally focused in Saudi Arabia. Who from the Saudi regime would have been involved with killing Khashoggi? Was that a special operation? But it was an assassination nonetheless, silencing a political dissident. So yes, this harkens back to a Cold War playbook, but it's even broader than it was historically. It's not just Russia anymore. It's other countries that are operating, in particular in Europe. But sanctions are being used, and I can't really speak to what kind of covert action measures from some of the countries that are aggrieved. I know that Germany is very concerned. I know that I believe it was the Netherlands or France was very concerned. So I'll just pause there.
Also, question. My sound got a little weird. Wondering your thoughts on the recent bombing of the liaison building by North Korea, the peace liaison building. And that would be interesting to hear from the viewing, the geospatial viewing, and then the impact. What do we think here?
Yeah, I mean, I'll take a shot at that. I am reminded when Chris talked about numbering units that the Soviets were quite rigid in that, and it made again our intelligence jobs a little bit easier because there were just things that they rigidly adhered to, and in fact, it really used to bother them, and it bothers the Russians a little bit now that we turn out volumes and volumes of doctrine, but we don't follow it. And then they can't, it's difficult culturally for them to understand why we don't. But one thing we did used to do was we would purposefully misnumber some of our units so that they wouldn't be able to understand. It would drive them crazy that we'd maybe, number something 1, 2, 3, 6 and 9. And then they would spend a great deal of time trying to find those ones they thought they were missing. In any event, with respect to North Korea, that was very public. That was public diplomacy of blowing up that facility. It made a statement. It's how they operate. So there was no confusion about that. There was no requirement to have to figure it out using classified methods. They wanted us to see it. We saw it. They made sure. And it was a statement about their displeasure with the current government in South Korea and some of the things that they're doing, and probably a little message and a little attention grabbing for us.
Keith did a great job on that.
What are your thoughts on using the contact tracing apps as they've done in other countries regarding the, of course, the virus?
So I think Apple and Google have sort of taken the lead on this and have pledged to put in a number of protections that in fact you would be alerted that you had come close to somebody who ultimately had been identified, but that information would not be loaded up to the cloud. It would not go beyond your device, and it would enable you with knowledge, but it wouldn't put you at risk. Clearly I've touched on some of this. We're in a tough time where the devices that we're all using are leaving a trail. It's very clear, very easy to track commercially. You have far more to worry about people collecting your information for retail and marketing and insurance purposes, because there is no protection against that versus the fact that the United States government, the intelligence community, cannot collect that about you. So look, contact tracing apps, things that are going to show adherence to quarantine, all very, very important as we face the threat of COVID-19. But we have to understand, as with anything, there's going to be trade-offs. So I am pleased with what I've seen of this Apple, Google app so far.
Cool. I think we have time for, one final question. And I feel terrible because we have a ton of great ones, but I think we've got to go back and get both of your perspectives, because this changes week by week, on the upcoming election and interference, because I want to hear, I think Keith's perspective would be interesting on that. So let's close it out with any thoughts on foreign interference in our election process.
Yeah, look, we, the United States of America, have been interfering in elections certainly as long as I've been on this earth. And it's part of the toolkit of diplomacy and intelligence. And that's just the way it is. And how you define interference, it could be something as small as just supporting a candidate and providing them monetary support, or some sort of informational propaganda support, or it can get much, much more nefarious. And then the cyber age, obviously, we saw in the last election cycle how damaging it is. I spent 12 years cultivating a great following and engagement on Twitter, and I think you may have seen, Amanda, I recently just sort of dropped off because it was revealed, for instance, that 50% of the tweets about demanding unlocking the United States were from foreign bots. And that is a problem that's really largely something that could be dealt with if there was the will to do it. Humans aren't tweeting 100 times a second. Humans aren't tweeting from 10 different countries in 1 minute either. So not too hard to figure out that that's not a human. They're going to come after us again. Yes, it's a problem. And yes, we have to be mindful of it.
So I know we only have a minute left. I feel like I've been beating this drum for some time, but I just want to underscore and foot stomp again that disinformation was practiced throughout the Cold War and before by the Soviet Union. The Russians are very adept. The Iranians are less adept, but they will continue to do state-sponsored disinformation operations. But we're extremely vulnerable right now because we have a polarized society, and the disinformation campaign that started in advance of the 2016 election is all about undermining confidence in the US government. It started before 2016. It's going to continue through November. And if you think where we are as a nation, understand that Russia, unfortunately, is going to continue to sow discord. It's even been determined that they are causing discord and trying to take advantage, and this shouldn't be a surprise, of the problems in the questions of race, and they will exploit that as well. And the administration has called that out before George Floyd was killed. So this is going to continue through November. And I would just urge everyone to pay attention to their sources of information, go to multiple sources, be your own intelligence officer. Don't react to that text message that says a group of violent looters are coming into your neighborhood, they're moving, and you start tweeting that off. In some cases, that is active disinformation. I could give countless examples just in the last month, but it's serious, but I think the American public are intelligent people, so they will sort through the news as we get up to the election, and they'll make the right decisions.
Well, I want to thank you both for answering all manner of questions, and we will share with you the questions that you didn't get, so you can, if you are willing, answer those via email. I want to thank everyone for joining us today for this conversation. Can't thank our sponsors, EKS Group, enough. We really appreciate your support. And next week at this time, we'll have something completely different. We'll have our Curator's Corner with Vince Houghton, and we'll be talking to a variety of spy fiction writers, people with really interesting backgrounds. The luminary among that group is Brad Thor, and he is a huge bestseller with the Scott Horvath series, like 19 of these novels. So if you want a taste, and they'll talk about how reality influences their plots, but I want to thank these great people for telling us just about reality and trying to disabuse us of some of the fictions. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks so much, Amanda. Thank you, Keith.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and want to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.